When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it's Sammy here, and this episode of Fulhamish is supported by NordVPN. Now, NordVPN is a way of watching sporting events, TV shows, and films which aren't available where you are by switching your virtual location of your phone, tablet, or laptop to a country which is. Particularly perfect for those 3 p.m. kickoffs which aren't televised in the UK. And right now, you can get an exclusive discount by going to nordvpn.com/Fulhamish. Not only will you benefit from their already huge discount, but you'll also get an extra 4 months for free. You can use one account on up to 6 devices. Also, it's completely no risk thanks to Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. So to get that special rate plus 4 free months, go to nordvpn.com/Fulhamish or hit the link in the description of this podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
It's the Fulhamish podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC. My name's Sammy James and welcome to the show. Today we'll be previewing our game against Crystal Palace this Saturday. Is there anything more mid-table, more irrelevant really to the rest of the wider world than Fulham versus Crystal Palace this Sunday at Craven Cottage? We'll have a nice time. Just no one else will know that we will have. I'm joined by, I'm delighted to say, the regular Thursday crew today. Jack Collins, hello.
Hello, Sammy. How you doing?
Good, thank you. And he's back from gallivanting to Paris, Barcelona, checking out how much sewage there is in the River Seine. Peter Rutzler, hello.
Hello. Hey, guys. How you doing? You all right?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. Nice to have you back.
It is good to see you, mate.
You've had some nice trips, haven't you?
I've been busy, yeah, hopping back and forth, but it's been, yeah, and there've been some crazy games as well. The Champions League quarterfinals were pretty out there as football goes, so we'll take that. Bit of Olympics thrown in as well the other week, so it's been all go. It's been all go, and then back to the cottage at the weekend where it's all happening.
Let's have a final word on that Liverpool game. To be honest, I've done the quick take and the podcast, so I haven't got any more words on the game. But Jack, you haven't been on Fulhamish since Sunday, so you've probably got a few things to say. I mean, it was just one of those where Liverpool returned to form and Fulham weren't quite good enough to deal with a very impressive Liverpool side that annoyingly decided to return to form with the game against us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very impressed that you managed to do both a quick take and a podcast, because I really didn't have that much to say. And I remember sitting in the pub afterwards and being like, it sort of is what it is, right? Like, there's not loads you can say about that game. It was okay in the first half, and there were periods where Fulham looked bright and sharp. The second half was sloppy. Liverpool took advantage. One team really needed and wanted that, and the other didn't. And I think that, whilst that's not me saying that Fulham players weren't trying or any of those things before, it's taken out of context. It's just one side has a burning desire and, you know, and desperation almost to pick those points back up. And I think actually in some ways, Jurgen Klopp playing a slightly understrength is probably the wrong word, but a rotated side that allowed a few players to sort of stand up and be like, no, I need to be in. I need to be playing. Cody Hakpo, I thought, was brilliant. Harvey Elliott, much to the chagrin of the Fulham faithful, was absolutely brilliant as well, I thought. And I can't say much apart from I thought Liverpool were the better side for pretty much the whole game. There were spells for Fulham in the first half. They kind of shot themselves in the foot with some of the passes and sort of errant balls in the second half. And once Liverpool took the lead again for the second time, I didn't really feel like there was any way back.
Yeah, Peter, your thoughts on the match?
Yeah, I echo Jack really, and also especially about admiration for multiple takes on that game, because I had the same issue at full time. I was trying to think, what do I write about here from a Fulham perspective, because it felt like there was some familiar ground, but also I think, and that's what we've sort of eventually landed on, was how Jack summed up, you know, it is what it is. I think this is taking into a wider context, you know, it's not a bad place to be where, yeah, you, okay, lost to a better team on the day, but that better team is one of the best teams in the league. And I think considering, even as a from a season perspective, the fact that Fulham are where they are, comfortable knowing that this kind of defeat against a team that you know is superior, but it didn't really matter so much. It's quite nice and just a bit stress-free. And as much as it was disappointing, you can just shrug it off and enjoy your Sunday to an extent, which I think has been quite rare over the past decade or so. Following Fulham, I know we've talked about that before. So, yeah, exactly as Shaq said, first half was pretty even, felt quite tight. Fulham were clinical when they had their best spell. It's nice to see Timothy Castagne get on the score sheet. I think he's been incredibly consistent this season. I think he's been a real standout. Not standout, that's the opposite I was going to say. He's been very consistent and solid without standing out. And yeah, it's a shame the result didn't go that way, but he's clearly improving. And obviously there's the context of Kenny Tete and what's going on with him. So it was good to see. And then second half was, took until the 83rd minute for Fulham to have a shot. It was a different game after the break. And I don't think you can be overly critical of Fulham. I think they dropped a little bit deeper than they would have liked. I think Liverpool upped their intensity, upped their pressure, showed why they are where they are in the table. And yeah, took the game away from Fulham, really. And then that's probably the only disappointing aspect. But yeah, I mean, any more thoughts, Sammy? Come on, really stretch the boat. Really, really.
I did read something that I thought you'd like from the ever brilliant Jack and Loz with their blog at the Cottage. And I think they were like, there was a lot of talk of king makers and king breakers. Half this Fulham team looked like they couldn't make a bed in the morning. And I was like, oh, wow. It really did hit home. I was like, very good. And we were the ones talking about king makers and king breakers. You know, sometimes those opportunities open themselves out. I think if Liverpool had been below par, or, you know, strictly below par, then we could have maybe made them pay. And we've been good exploiting weaknesses. The flip side of that is that when they did put the pedal to the floor, they were able to get the job done. But I do think a better Liverpool side probably puts four or five past Fulham in that kind of game where it is loose and errant, whereas this side are not quite where they were. And that's what I texted to, you know, the lads I did the previews with Cop TV and stuff beforehand with. That's what I said to them. I was like, I think you beat us by more if you are more cohesive.
Mm. I mean, it was just nothing to write home about. And I guess sometimes that is the side point of like beating teams like Spurs and Arsenal, is that there becomes a bit of an expectation about sometimes getting these great results. Whereas we have to remember that last season we didn't get a single result against the top sides.
Also, their rarity makes them special, right?
Yeah, there's that. I think there's a balance, right? I think we're talking about the long desire to be mid-table and to be sort of distinctly, not distinctly average, that feels a bit harsh, but in the context of the Premier League, that's fine. But to be mid-table, but just to have the hope that you might win, and that's what a result against Tottenham gives you, a result against Arsenal gives you, it's what Fulham's home form gives you, it's what a run to the Carabao Cup semi-finals gives you. It's the hope of better and the belief that they can do better. And I think they can. I think if they could find some consistency, then there is that, oh, maybe Fulham could push higher on the table. Maybe they could go higher than 10th. And I think you need that if you're in that area of the Premier League table. The idea that if the cards fall in the right way, you can win these games. They're not write-offs. And I think that's actually probably one mark of progress from last year, that there is more of a sense that actually, yes, Fulham were competitive last year, but actually they can take results. So, and while that might make these kind of results sting a little bit more, I don't know, I think that's a stretch, but I think that's worth taking. Just the idea that you can beat Liverpool. I think Fulham could and probably should have at least beaten Liverpool once this season. They deserve to. I mean, what I saw Codger's Tactica, I think, putting out the XG for the 10 goals Fulham have conceded this season. It was like 0.8 or something ridiculous from 10 goals. I mean, come on, like that's just mental. And Fulham have burnt Leno in goal as well. It's not like, you know, it's not like you're blaming anyone for the quality of some of the goals conceded. Like Trent Alexander-Arnold's free kick in the first half, completely even half, and he sticks one postage stamp over the wall. you just don't save it. Yeah. You don't save that.
You knew it was coming though. I stood with Dean at this and it was Dean and I and Dean's 6-year-old Dylan. And Dean said to Dylan, he said, look, watch the right-hand corner of the goal. The ball's going to go in the top corner there. And the ball went in and just went, told you so. And Dylan was like, wow, like you really know football. It was like one of those really sort of nice moments to witness between a father and son. But more than anything, I was like, as soon as he lined it up, I was like, I think this is going in. I think this is going in. And that's what quality free kick takers do, right? They put the ball in when you expect them to. There's nothing anybody can do about it.
And at least this free kick was Trent Alexander-Arnold's and not a Bernd Leno own goal like the last one, which was such an injustice that day.
I did enjoy the contrast between that and Harvey Elliott's attempt just before, which was absolutely terrible. I think, was he trying to go under?
I don't know, he was trying to go under the wall.
I was just surprised that he'd managed to pull rank over Trent Alexander-Arnold for that free kick. Maybe it's because he was back at Craven Cottage and was getting some stick that he thought, well, and then Trent's like, okay, have it. But
you're not having another one.
Liverpool fans get so wound up by Fulham fans booing Harvey Elliott as if there's a bigger, wider, deeper meaning to it all, other than that he's just a player that left us and that's what happens in football. I just don't know why they get...
I think it is more than that. I absolutely. It's not like we don't boo every player that leaves the club in the way that you boo, that Fulham fans boo Harvey Elliott. You don't boo Ryan Sessegnon.
No, you boo players that...
He left on bad terms, and that's why, and that's fine. Also, like, I don't have a huge problem with this. It's not a major issue. Harvey Elliott's, you know, there was a wry smile in the first half after the first chorus calling him an obscenity, which was quite amusing to see. And look, he obviously used it as fuel because he played really well across the course of this. It's absolutely fine for Fulham fans to be upset about the manner and way in which Harvey Elliott left the club. It's also fine, you know, for them to be like, maybe stop doing that. It doesn't mean that Fulham have to do it.
Yeah.
They have to listen. This is all just pantomime, isn't it? At the end of the day.
Yeah.
I've sat there and interviewed Harvey Elliott and spoke to him about this and discussed it with him. And I came out of that with a slightly different opinion on how it all went down and all of those things. But that's not the average viewpoint. And that's fine. Like, it's fine for me, like, someone's walked out of here and left a club that helped bring them through and made them their youngest ever senior player and literally wouldn't sign a contract and left for free. Yes, okay, it was the club that he has supported since he was a boy, to the club that, you know, his family supports, all of those things. But it doesn't make it any less painful for Fulham fans. And the tribunal, a year and a half, 2 years later, that eventually decided a fee, doesn't really affect the mentality of how fans feel about that. It's wild to think that people are getting upset about Fulham fans being upset about Harvey Elliott. It's like people being upset about other people's emotions. Weird.
Yeah, I don't really. It's all the pantomime for me. Players either kind of leave on good terms or bad terms, and the ones that leave on bad terms, you boo. It's just a bit of fun of the football for me. I don't think there's too much more to it. And I find it mad that Liverpool fans seem to be a bit holier than thou on that subject. Speaking of Liverpool fans, we probably should address, Jack, that a lot of people, myself included, who wouldn't be unhappy, but there were a lot of Liverpool fans that jumped up when that Trent Alexander-Arnold free kick went in particular. I noticed it less for the second and third goals in the second half, although it felt like the Putney end was returning to its good old neutral end days with the way that half that stand was a bloody Uruguayan flag in the home end of the Putney end, which last time I checked, we don't have a Uruguayan player playing for Fulham. So I think we know who that was for and what their allegiances might be. I know that a lot of people think that I have any opportunity to criticise the club. I think it's a really difficult problem to solve. These kind of big games against Liverpool, United and away fans getting in the home end. It felt particularly bad on Sunday and particularly in the Hammersmith end. It was pretty charged in one section where obviously some fans had celebrated. I think it was about H6 halfway down. And until the club finds a way of stopping this happening, it's just going to keep continuing. And I think there was some real anger in the stand when that happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's just managing it. You know, I think it's always going to happen in terms of you're never going to get a thing that's perfect where everyone, you know, you keep everybody out. And look, I can't sit here and be like, I've never done this, because I have gone and sat in home ends that Fulham are playing where I can't get a ticket and shut up and kept my head down. And there is something with that as well, right? And I know that my brother and dad were saying that just in front of them, there was someone who was just filming everything. They didn't film the Fulham goal and got a bit of yap at that point for someone being like, you didn't film that, did you? And then literally turned around and started filming the Fulham fans, like as a sort of response, but didn't film so much in the second half. Look, it happens. There are going to, you know, these things. The problem is that if people are sitting there, heads down, obviously it's not great for atmosphere. I absolutely understand that. But if people are not making a scene, et cetera, then there's not loads you can do about it, right? There's not, you're not going to be like, you can't stand here and watch the game because there's no evidence to provide in either direction. But when people do jump up and stuff, I think the anger is kind of exacerbated by the fact that it took so long for anyone to do anything about it. And even then, at that point, you know, people have been pointed out, stewards, all of these things. That's when mob justice starts to come into its own right, right? And that's not me condoning it for its worth, but those are the moments that spirals out of control because there's no one being able to deal with it. And I was talking to the stewards at halftime, not in that segment, but who were like, what happened over there? And I was like, I think it was a Liverpool fan. They were like, did they get thrown out? I was like, I don't know. I couldn't really see, but it did look like eventually they got taken out. And the bloke was like, I just don't know why you jump up, man. I just don't understand. And I was like, no, you're absolutely right. Like, he was like, I've seen away ends before. You know, I keep my head down. I go there, I watch the game and I get out. I was like, yeah, that's what a normal person would do. So I think it's a matter of, in terms of controlling the atmosphere and controlling how angry people get, of just making sure that when incidents do occur, they're dealt with swiftly and properly. And that's what I think is going wrong at the moment.
Yeah, and I also think that a lot of goodwill has been lost, and maybe if there was more goodwill between the fans and the club, that maybe these kind of things, people would be less angry at the club. Peter, I don't know if you noticed particularly a lot of jumping up around you. I know in the press area, obviously, there will be some Liverpool kind of officials and things like that that might be a bit almost entitled to celebrate if they wish. But yeah, I don't know if you particularly noticed it where you sat.
It wasn't like the Newcastle game in the FA Cup where we had a couple right in front of us who were celebrating. I think Jack's right about the culture. I think it's because you go to a game and you don't want that tension if you're sitting next to someone who could attract that kind of ire. Like, that takes away from enjoying why you're going. I also have a lot of sympathy for the stewards because it's an incredibly difficult position to be in. Like, these guys are not paid a lot of money to do what they're doing. There's a massive shortage of stewards at most clubs in London, probably across the country. So not easy. What I did see in the Liverpool game, there were two Liverpool fans who were thrown out of the Johnny Haynes in the first half, and they were sort of waved off by fans around. And then I could see there was some commotion in the Hammersmith end, but I think there was also a medical incident as well. So I hope whoever is involved is okay. But yeah, that was all. It wasn't like the Newcastle game. It tends not to be with the league matches. Putney End's different, but I mean, that's the first time I've seen stewards take someone out around me anyway, where I'm sitting. So in terms of that, it seemed quite proactive. But, you know, I mean, it's difficult because you can have people say, well, these are these people that they've got to see it, right? They've got to prove it. You can't just throw someone out. Like, just turn around and you don't like them. And it turns out they're actually just Fulham fans you don't like. So
might try it. Next game.
There's a balance.
This guy supports Palace. Stewards just be like, yeah, and like, fair enough. It's Palace. You're like, oh, yeah, fair enough. Good point.
There's a couple of maybe footnotes that I wanted to add to this. First of all is, and this has never happened to me before, so I went to the game and I was wearing the classic 0102 Pizza Hut away shirt. It's one of my favourites. Red and black stripes, red down the middle. So I had a jacket on, so you could only really see the middle of my shirt, and it was red. And as I went through the turnstile, the guy didn't allow me to open the turnstile because he said, excuse me, sir, what's that shirt? Because he thought it was a Liverpool shirt. Which I was actually, obviously, I just opened my jacket and he was like, oh, that's an absolute classic of the genre. On you go, sir. But
did he use this many sirs?
No.
That's my big question.
No one's ever called
me
sir.
No one's ever called you sir in your life.
But I was reasonably impressed that there was some level of check, you know, kudos where it is. And also, I actually remember, never brought this up on the pod, you might have seen when Brentford played United a few weeks ago. It was absolutely daylight robbery. I think Brentford had about 50 shots on target and ended 1-1. And United very nearly nicked it. Mason Mount scored. Brentford then went and equalised. Mason Mount scored where the Man United away fans were, the amount of home away fans in the home end that also jumped up at Brentford was enormous. Like yeah. It was huge. And it did make me think that, like, you know, Brentford is a club that off the pitch, I would like Fulham to be more like. Like, I think they do things generally. They're much more modern, sophisticated. They're much better, I think, at like managing things like ticket issues and stuff. And
so they've got their own problems at the moment.
And I think like it clearly shows that like lots of clubs have this problem. I know Palace have this problem too. Like yeah. It is not unique to Fulham that away fans get in. But look, I don't think that should mean that like Fulham are excused from it. I think they have to work harder in order to figure out who the season ticket touts are. They exist. Like, who is selling on their tickets at inflated prices to away fans, how that's all happening. I think it's important for everyone's enjoyment because it, you know, it got pretty tense at point. I mean, I was nowhere near it, but like that's not adding to anyone's enjoyment when things like that happen in the first half.
Did give the atmosphere a bit of a boost, I'll be honest. Off goal.
quickly, I had a message from Jakob, who's part of the Fulham Supporters Trust, and he said that if you discuss this and if there's any kind of issues or concerns that people want to raise about what happened on Sunday, maybe you had an away fan particularly near you, etc., the Fulham Supporters Trust would like people to email them contact@fulhamsupporterstrust.com, give your feedback, tell them what happened, and then they can raise that directly to the club at their next meeting. So if you've got something you'd like to get it off your chest, email the Supporters Trust and they will try and raise it to the club at the next meeting. Quickly, Peter, a couple of pieces that you've written in the last week have been about certain players' futures. Kenny Tete and Willian were the two that you wrote articles about. Both of them, it looks like, might be getting new deals, but obviously both of them are at slightly different stages of the discussions.
Yeah, I don't think with Willian, it's pretty much the same position as it's been for a while. Same as last season, will be discussed at the end of the year. He's given a couple of interviews in Brazil where he's been like, yeah, open to opportunities. And Marco Silva just said on Friday that he will do his best to keep him. I think he's an interesting one in that he's quite clearly very key to the way Fulham play. But I think we all know that there has to be a longer term solution on the left hand side. He's 35. So I think that's that. I think Kenny Tete is interesting. The piece I wrote late last week, just outlining that Fulham had put an offer on the table for him to sign, to renew his contract. That's not really a surprise. You would have been more surprised if Fulham hadn't offered any terms. Yeah. Marco Silva's, you know, previously talked about conversations ongoing. There's also this option in his contract. And I think the point is that that's going to have to be triggered reasonably soon. You know, once we get into May, clubs have to file their retained and release lists. So that those discussions should really come to a head soon. You know, and also in the piece, I point out that Fulham are looking at other right backs as contingency, again, as you'd expect. I think it's, we all know what Kenny Tete can do. I think we all saw that last season. He's a popular player. He's a really fantastic one-on-one defender. This season's been difficult. He's had injuries, some genuine injury issues. And again, that's not new. But also he's had Timothy Castagne come in and be really consistent and solid, always available. As we mentioned earlier in the podcast, he's been playing very well. So I think obviously Fulham want two good right-backs, don't they? We'll have to see where Devon Tanton is. Obviously, he's broken into the first team this year in the Cup, but there will need to be a decision with Tete coming up soon and whether he does want to sign that new contract, whether Fulham then decide, okay, we'll just trigger the option and then consider what happens this summer, because a year extension doesn't rule much out. It's in terms of an exit, because it just gives you a position to sell. And he's coming up to 29, I think, this year, 28, 29. So he's in a key point in his career. Again, it's one to watch in the same way that Tosin's been one to watch and Bobby Decadova-Reed as well. So we're getting to that time of the year, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, Peter, just a quick one on Willian rather than Tete. But obviously, you know, as you say, the noises out of Brazil are that he's kind of open to opportunities. I don't necessarily think that means he's going to leave. But I think that obviously we talk about contingency plans and we talk about what Fulham are looking at there. Do you have any sort of steer on where the club are looking in terms of wingers? or what Fulham could be looking at in that kind of position to strengthen either if Willian goes or to kind of play under him as an understudy for a year?
Nothing concrete that I could say right now, but in terms of what they want to do this summer, those plans have been discussed. I think the only thing that hasn't really been outlined is budget. And I think a lot of that comes back to where they finish in the table plays a part. They still haven't finalised that. So in terms of what Marco Silva said in his press conferences, he said, you know, the players that I want and identified and we've discussed as targets, they're on the table. They've been planning ahead. So yeah, in terms of wide positions, it's nothing yet for you.
Rafa Silva on a free. Very excited.
Make it happen. One thing before we take a break and look ahead to Palace, I just thought we should quickly talk about Jay Stansfield. Because, well, firstly, I don't know if any of you have seen it, but a great interview that on the official Fulham podcast that Ivan and Felix did with Gordon Davies, obviously Fulham's all-time record goal scorer. And there was a lovely clip of Gordon tipping Jay Stansfield to one day beat his record of 178 wow. goals for Fulham.
Wow, that's bold. That is bold.
He said that Jay can get 200 goals for Fulham. Well, I'd love to see it.
I mean, I'd be delighted. just that record stood for, what, 50 years?
I think if Mitrovic stayed at Fulham to the end of his career, I remember thinking that, like, he could.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's one of those. It's just one of those records that's lasted for so long that tipping. You can think about some of the wonderful strikers we've had, you know, Luis Saha, Alexander Mitrovic, as you say.
Well, none of them stay long enough to get anywhere near that.
That's the problem, because if Jay starts scoring the amount of goals that he's going to need per season in order to come near that record, people are going to come sniffing around him.
Yeah. And also, I felt like a little bit of a poor old snub on Rodrigo, who was on a rate of one a game up until very recently. But look, Jay's got a couple of massive games, because as well as I feel like Jay's loan spell at Birmingham has gone personally, it's obviously been an absolute disaster on the pitch for Birmingham. They were in the playoffs when they got rid of John Eustace. Obviously, they had the Wayne Rooney disaster.
I mean, karma does come into it. I mean, I obviously feel sorry for Jay Stansfield at the club, but they were in such a good position that they decided to literally burn all of their bridges down on purpose. It is unbelievably funny in some ways.
They have got two massive games. So Birmingham are in the Championship relegation zone.
And they drew with Rotherham at the weekend.
With Rotherham, which is obviously
Stansfield had a goal ruled out. It was a really good strike, but it was someone offside in the way.
He is so on form, though. I mean, he's got three goals in his last five games. A man of the match performance against Coventry as well. And they face Huddersfield on Saturday, who are the other team, other than Rotherham, who are in the Championship relegation zone, who are pretty woeful. I mean, Peter, it's a, I don't know, with loan players, you obviously just want them to go and kind of have a trouble-free time when they're playing. But actually, do you think this maybe is going to put be good for Jay Stansfield, especially if Birmingham can come through and achieve safety, which is more than possible? There are plenty of teams that Birmingham can catch.
Yeah, I think overall it's been a good loan spell, because he's been there, he's played games and he's scored important goals in high pressure situations. I saw him speak, I can't remember the game, but he scored a, Jack, you might be able to remember, but he scored a late one-on-one, and he hadn't scored for a while. And it was one of those goals where you've got like 30, 40 yards to cover on the ball. It's all in your head, right? And he scored that. And I think when your team is battling relegation, where you're having, I think it sounded like some unfair sort of reflections on his form, to be able to come through that to score is those are the kind of formative experiences you want. I think, like, you know, he joined the team when John Eustace was in charge. We talked about how, you know, half the Championship were trying to sign him on loan at the time, and it looked like a good move. And then obviously Eustace goes, there's been upheaval, different managers. I think in January there was a genuine discussion about, well, does he stay at Birmingham? Is it better to put him in a different place? Tony Mowbray comes in and is obviously renowned for his work with young players. Obviously, Tony Mowbray's been unwell, so hope he recovers and gets well soon. I mean, the whole thing has been quite difficult, but you learn a lot from that. You know, you learn a lot from that. I think playing for a club as big as Birmingham City, with the fan base that it has and the expectations that come with it, I think that's all part of that process. So I don't, there's no doubt for me, the fact that he's been playing, this will certainly stand him in good stead to dealing with these kind of situations. What you don't want is a scenario where, one, he's not playing, two, there's not much, you're not doing anything that's different to what you would be if you were just training and getting the odd 5 minutes at Fulham, without any pressure on it. I think this is a good thing to be in,
isn't it? A bit of jeopardy.
Yeah, I suppose that's one way of putting it. I think as a loan, it's obviously not gone. I think as probably wasn't initially planned, but like the experiences, I think, is what counts. And as long as he's playing and scoring and feeling like he is developing, then that's a good place to be.
All right, well, we'll take a break there. Afterwards, we'll look ahead to Palace.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Part two of the Fulhamish podcast. Sammy here with Jack and Peter. Thank you to Green King Sport for sponsoring the Thursday Club this season. Head to your local Green King Sport pub to watch all the big matches during the final run-in of the season. Any televised sport, whether it's on TNT, whether it's on Sky, obviously you've got big Champions League matches coming up, big Europa League matches coming up for Jack, big Conference League matches. Of course, our game against Manchester City is on TNT Sports next Saturday. If you can't head down to the Cottage, head to your local Green King Sport pub. And if you get the Green King Sports app, not only will you get access to exclusive deals and competitions, you'll also get 10% off your drinks whilst there's any televised sport on. So that's your local Green King Sport pub. Head there to watch all the action during the big run-in. Let's look ahead to Crystal Palace, which is not one of the games in the big run-in, but it is for Fulham. It's a chance to equal the most amount of home wins in a season. Don't know if you knew that. I think that 10 is the record. We're currently on 9. So that'd be a nice one to tick off. And Peter, Palace is one of those teams that we've just had a bit of a mixed record really against. Obviously, we had the brilliant win last year at Selhurst, the draw at a very similar stage of the season last year where it was a 2-2. It was just one of those nice days, wasn't it? It was sunny and everyone just had a nice time. A bit of a drab 0-0 draw earlier in the season. I said on Monday's podcast that this screams draw. It like might as well spell out the word score draw. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, well, I think the result against West Ham was a little bit of a surprise. I think that indicates the direction of travel they're going under the new coach, Oliver Glasner, and it also shows what they're capable of when they have their best players available. And I think that's kind of like most teams in this area of the table. You know, you have your players that are star personnel who probably could make the step up. I'm talking about Michael Olise, Eberechi Eze. What an unbelievable bicycle kick he scored. And I feel like they had a really difficult spell. And I remember my colleague Matt Woosnam wrote a piece being like, this is why Crystal Palace are not going to get relegated this season. And it was before they went and beat Liverpool. I was looking at the table and their fixtures were really tough, and it was, you know, they're only about, what was it, 6 points? Three? I can't remember how many, but it was not very far away. And considering the fixtures they had, I was like, this is quite the take, you know, this is quite bold. But he was adamant, and then they obviously went and beat Liverpool. So clearly he's close to the ground and knows his stuff and knew the direction they're going in. But their season hasn't been where they'd want it to be. It's been quite disruptive. They're in this, you know, position of being where Fulham have wanted to be for a long time, but aren't enjoying it because they've been mid-table without the fun factor. But I think when you start adding results like Fulham have had this season, like beating Forest and West Ham 5-0, Palace beating West Ham 5-2, they've beaten Liverpool, it changes your perception. And I think they're coming into it with a bit more optimism about what's happening in the future. And that makes it an interesting game because it puts the two teams kind of in a similar position. I mean, their squads are different in terms of profile, but I think there are some similarities with Palace. I mean, what kind of statement's that? Bloody hell, hot take of the year. Talk about running out of takes, Jesus. It's your classic mid-table game, but it's interesting. And I think for Fulham coming into it, Fulham are coming into it from a position of we've got ourselves back to the point where we are, where Palace are, and for a long time that's been the ambition, and that's why it's might be a mid-table game to savour, I suppose, is what I'm trying to get at. If that's ever a thing.
I think you're right. There's kind of more to it than that. I think in that, as you say, Fulham have something to play for, in that it's the last real winnable home game of the campaign. Probably it's the one that you look at and be like, oh, can we end this on a high? Obviously, the City game has its own kind of trials and trepidations around it, and there's lots to kind of think about with that game. But it's a bit of a different experience in that, you know, that is a, if Fulham get something, it will be a major shock. Whereas this is kind of like, oh, can you end the campaign at home on a high? You know, in a kind of sense of being like, and also take it into the derby against Brentford as well, you know, find a bit of rhythm, a bit of form ahead of that game. Palace look like they're now building for next season, obviously switch managers halfway through the campaign. Glasner's come in. The last two results have been very impressive in very different ways. And they'll be kind of looking at this point of being like, okay, so can we just get ourselves onto a footing that when we start next season, we know what we're going to expect. And that's, you know, they've basically got a launch pad, if you will, into next year without anything really to worry about. They can experiment, try things. I mean, you know, you talk about the great strike trios of history. You talk about the BBC at Real Madrid. You talk about MSN at Barcelona. Now looking at the EMO, Crystal Palace, because Eze, Mateta and Elise, that's the E-Tour West Ham apart the weekend. So
EMO. Well,
shouts out to EMO. But it's, yeah, I mean, look, I think it is one of those games which should be quite fun. As we say, there's not loads on the line for either team, which maybe means that you can experiment a little bit. People can try things. There'll be probably a little bit more looseness associated with the game. And that might just be what it needs as a neutral. I mean, not for me as a neutral, but what it needs for the neutral to be able to just tune into a game that really shouldn't mean much to the Premier League at this point in the season.
I was just trying to think of what maybe one like an iconic Fulham front three, and can it make an acronym? I got as far as WKM for Wilson, Mitrovic, and Cabano, but it's not quite as catchy as BBC, MSN, or EMO.
Yeah, I'll have a think about it. I'll get one for next year.
Okay, cool. Maybe I know. You know, is there something we can do with like Saha, Malbronk, Boamorte? It doesn't, again, like, it's got to be a good one out there that we can make for Fulham.
Yeah.
What about Wham of William Adama and Muniz?
It's very rarely on the pitch together.
Have we ever seen it? Actually?
Yeah, it is good.
I don't know. One day we'll get Wham.
I can't wait for Wham. If William stays on the pitch and Adama comes on Saturday, I'm just going to tweet and I'm just going to text Peter immediately like, yes, we've deployed Wham.
Wow.
Can't wait.
Wake me up before you go.
I mean, if Pereira is included, you could call it Wamp.
That's even worse. I love how you thought you'd improved it. I don't know what you were thinking about. You're like, oh, wicked. I've sorted this out. I'll just add a word that does makes it not a word. Cool.
If it's Adama, Ferreira and Muniz, it's Pam.
Right.
The drama, Mick. I love it.
All right. Have we got much more to say on Crystal Palace? They play on Wednesday night.
Yeah, we're recording before Palace plays. So there's not loads we can say about that game.
No, but yet. That's, you know, I've always thought, you know, it definitely fell in our favour in the West Ham game where they play midweek, we don't. It's always something to factor in. Yeah. It's not always the be-all and end-all as to whether it means our Fulham are now definitely going to win. But it's always a nice little advantage when we're sat at home with our feet up and they've got to play a pretty tough game.
Yeah, I mean, our job is just beach. Speech. We got our feet up a lot of the time, including the second half on Saturday. So, I mean, I hope that they're feeling rested and ready for this one.
Any changes that you think might be likely, Peter? I had a thought with the way that the club really played down the Willian injury and the fact that I felt like we really missed him. It wasn't necessarily anything that Bobby did wrong on the left wing. I think we just miss Willian's guile and experience in the team. It's not necessarily like Bobby came in and did a terribly bad job on the left wing. I would have thought that if Willian's free and fit, he'll come.
He's free. What, as if he's just like off for a weekend away?
He might be busy at he might be busy at the restaurant. You never know. He's got a lot of side hustles.
Yeah, I mean, Decatur Reed had like a very specific tactical role, I think, in that game, which was just deal with Trent and wherever he sort of goes. And I think he's done that before. So I think that probably was why he was used. But yeah, you'd imagine William would come back. Maybe it's a game for TC. Again, he's in this battle between Lukic and Kearney. It's a difficult game to judge, I think, Liverpool. Their midfield is pretty decent. I felt like they had more dominance than you'd probably want, considering the rotations that Liverpool had made. And I do wonder, I don't think Pellegrini's been bad, but he's not been as emphatic as he was last year, or at least in this recent run, I think, in the last few months. We haven't seen him dominate games, which he has done so lately. So I'm not saying to drop him, but a way of trying to get him back to that point, because he'll want to build some momentum for the Euros. You know, I think that's quite important.
If he if he'd had one more booking, I would have dropped him for this game, because I think the risk of missing the Brentford game is just not one we want to go through again. Well, we've had that. We've done that. Another, that was not fun.
If he'd had another booking in that game, he would have been sent off, though.
No. I just mean if he had another booking at this point, not in the last game.
Oh, right. Obviously.
But if he was on 14, if he was sitting at 14 instead of 13, I would have rested him. I'd be like, nah, we'll have you in the derby. You can get your suspension then, and that's fine. And that'll take you to the end of the season, and that's dusted. But I don't know. I think I'd be tempted to rotate. I'd be tempted to rotate Tosin out. Unless there is movement in these contract talks, or, you know, I thought his performance against Liverpool was pretty erratic, to be perfectly honest with you. I thought it was one of those where he looked like he'd do something good and then give the ball away, or he'd play a really good pass and the next two would go out of play. Just one of those games where he has an up and down. And I think that there is probably an argument to suggest that, you know, if he's not going to be here next year, then maybe start to try out that Diop and Bassey partnership to see if it, you know, gets any legs. Because, you know, at some point you have to start planning for the future. We just spoke about Palace, right? We just spoke about them looking at the future and kind of trying to find themselves a space for next season. Fulham should be doing the same with certain players as well. And so I think there's probably an argument to be made for that. I agree with Peter. I think this could be a Tom Kearney game, although I am interested to see how busy this Palace midfield looks under Glasner. I think Will Hughes has looked exceptional in the last few games. And honestly, I don't think I'd ever thought I'd be uttering that phrase. But he's looked really, really good in this Glasner system. And the way that he gets forward and helps out at the triangles has been really impressive.
I think Wharton's massively key to why Hughes looks a lot better. I think he's had a massive impact. He looks a really good midfielder.
Yeah, lovely. Lovely footballer and a good signing.
Yeah, his kind of rise from the Championship to the Premier League, like, I thought that transition would take a little bit longer than it has.
He looks very confident.
Yeah, he's settled right in right there. If you're coming to the Fulhamish live show after the Palace game, then we can't wait to see you. Peter's on the bill, which we're very excited about. So if you're coming to the live show afterwards, it's at the Half Moon Putney. If tickets aren't sold out, there might be only a couple left. So we're pretty much sold out. So there's a link in the description of the podcast. I actually don't 100% know the ticket sales, but I know it was very, very close. So doors open at 6 at the Half Moon. Part one's going to be at 6:15. George is going to be hosting. He's going to be joined by Dom Bett, Elizabeth Barnard and Dan Cook. And then part two is with me. And then the kind of dynamic journalism duo of Paddy Barclay and Peter Rutzler, and then just Farrell Monk, just the...
just for like comic relief.
Yeah. The Joker in the pack.
It's just like, you know, at the end of Question, you know, in Question Time, it's got a host, it's got some serious journalists, and then like Dappy from N-Dubs.
Poor old Fowl, he's not here to defend himself.
He'd love this.
He does see himself as the Dappy of M-Dubs of the
Fulhamish
podcast.
He's always said that to me.
He's always said that.
Oh, I didn't know he particularly compared himself to that bit of noughties pop royalty. And then there's This Will Catch On we'll be doing as well, which will be going in next week's Thursday Club. So we're very excited. We haven't snubbed Jack, by the way. You're not around.
No, I'm not here for the Palace game this weekend because I'm in Naples watching the Derby della Sole between Napoli and Roma, the Derby of the Sun. So I'm going to be there on Sunday whilst you're all watching Fulham and Palace draw 1-1. With a Peroni in one hand at the Maradona, watching Napoli and Roma play out a classic.
Well, you will be sorely missed, but I don't feel like you'll sorely miss us.
I will. I'm sad not to be there, but I am also incredibly excited about going to the Maradona because I've never been.
If that's the Derby of the Sun, what's Fulham Palace? What's that derby called?
Derby of the sort of small to mid-sized London clubs. Like
Derby de la match, last on match of the day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's a good one. Yeah, that's a good one.
That's the new name for it. All right, we'll take a break there. Peter's got to run because he's gone past his allotted time and we haven't got any more money to fill up the Peter Rossi meter.
Someone put 50p in Peter.
What a load of rubbish.
He's like on Cameo these days. We've paid for his time and we haven't got any more money to pay for any more. So Peter, thank you.
Unbelievable. Not getting a thanks after that. All the misinformation being spread on this podcast. Unbelievable.
And we'll be back in part three, me and Jack, for some questions.
And fake news.
Part three of the Fulhamish podcast. Oh, why did I do that?
Why did you sing it? Keep that in.
It is Sammy here, no more with Peter Rutzler, but still with Jack Collins. Hello.
Unfortunately for everybody listening, it's just descending into farce as we go along, isn't it? We'll try and answer some questions. You can see the season descending, can't you? Like the last three Thursday clubs, this is usually a quite sensible and nuanced podcast. And the last three have just been absolute chaos. So,
well, speaking of, my first question is very apt for chaos. Tom Rowe asks, on average, how many beers down are you when you record the quick take after a match?
Well, you do the quick take more than me, but I mean, on average, I probably have 2-3 pints before a game, one at half time, and at least one before I'd record. So five?
What this is upsetting for me is that this was sent after the Liverpool game. I drove to the Liverpool game, so I didn't drink. And then the beer that I was drinking during the quick take was a Freedam. It was a 0% lager. So I was literally sober. And it makes me worry about what I must have sounded like on the podcast, despite being 100. Normally, I have had a few beers, but I was driving on Sunday, so I didn't. And and then I got that question. I was a bit like, oh,
wonder if that's Tom Rowe from Ealing, who I used to knock around with. If it is Tom, send another email.
Okay. I particularly enjoyed that. Yeah, I mean, I do enjoy the quick takes, and generally, it might be like two or three beers in, and there's definitely a
fast and loose element to it.
Yeah, there's definitely a correlation between amount of beers and general rubbish takes.
We have seen a video of one of the quick takes. This is a Sheffield United one this week with Drew Healy on it, where he like actually fully can't speak, and we watched back. We're like, it's a very old one, but it was very. It might have been the live show last year.
Yeah, I remember this happening. So we did the live show after Sheffield United early in the season when we lost 3-1, and I just hadn't actually organised who was supposed to be on the quick take, and so I went. I'd finished packing up the live show, and I went over to a table, and I think Farrell might have been there. Dan was there. Drew was there. I was like, is anyone able to do the quick take with me for 10 minutes? And I was kind of thinking it might be Dan, who like seemed relatively coherent at that point and just generally is quite a coherent human being.
He's quite a sensible human.
And I asked it, and Drew, who I think he was a little bit like let off the leash because he's got a kid, and I think is
also it was, if I'm not mistaken, Drew was in part one and then not on the show again. So yeah. He had a few.
So he'd been on the source all day and he just stuck his hand out. I was like, me, I'll do it. And I genuinely thought at one point during that quick take he was actually going to hit like fall over and collapse into me. He was. If you want to go back and watch that quick take,
quite an enjoyable one.
Yeah,
but that's probably the most anyone's had, Tom.
Yeah, that was definitely the most kind of wavy quick take that I seem to remember. This next one is from Tim O'Mara. He says, Tim from Washington DC. I became a Fulham fan because my brother lives in London, equidistant from the cottage and Stamford Bridge. A year into his now 20-year stay in London, he realised he needed a team sport. He found Chelsea fans obnoxious, so Fulham it was. and has been. He's been a Fulham season ticket holder for over 15 years. Former USA and Everton keeper Tim Howard was providing studio colour for the USA TV production, said that he thought Liverpool was lucky to have played Fulham today because it's an easy place to play. I assume he means Craven Cottage. Can you comment on this? How can the Cottage become a more difficult place for away teams to play? Fulham's home record suggests winning there, even for big clubs, is not easy. Come on, Fulham, from Tim.
I think you've answered your own question in many ways, Tim. But I don't. I think that's a there's a viewpoint that because teams like coming to the Cottage because it's a nice place to play, because away fans like coming as well, that it maybe has a reputation as, you know, not, it's not a fearsome place to go in the way that Millwall is. But that doesn't mean that Millwall win at home more than Fulham. It's just the reputation around it. And actually, I think our home form's been pretty good in the last couple of years. We've won a lot of games at the Cottage. We've enjoyed ourselves a lot at the Cottage. We've put big teams in uncomfortable positions. And look, even the games where we haven't beaten Liverpool, this weekend aside, you know, we saw that 2-2 at the start of the last campaign. We saw the 1-1, obviously, in the Cup this year. The 2-1 against Arsenal, the 3-0 against Spurs. I think it's just one of those things that's perpetuated as an idea because Fulham is a pleasant club, which is fine. We shouldn't lose. So I don't think it's anything to worry about unless our home form drops off drastically, in which case maybe it needs addressing.
Yeah, I found that surprising thing for Tim Howard to say, particularly as he played for Everton, which famously was the team that always lost at Craven Cottage every single time they played there when he was...
Pretty sure he had a couple of stinkers when he was at United when we were at the Cottage as well. So maybe he's just bitter.
Yeah, I think like Fulham and Craven Cottage is one of those... I always remember... Gary Neville has famously always talked about how some of his games at the Cottage, it was one of the toughest places that he found to play. And he tells a story about how someone on the touchlines sang.
If the Nevilles played for England, so could I.
Yeah. I think there is that unique element to Fulham of the crowd being so close to the pitch. And whilst maybe like in terms of like if you got a decibel meter out and measured how loud Fulham is, it's probably incomparable to lots of clubs across Europe. I think that closeness to the pitch has famously rattled a lot of players down the years. You remember William Gallas getting sent off for Chelsea and doing the thumbs down to the crowd. I remember some of the Juve players getting quite wound up by the Fulham fans being so close, almost being the Johnny Haynes in particular. You're that close. It feels like some of the people on those front few rows can almost shout in the players' ears and get their attention. I think that's something quite unique to Fulham. And I think that plus the element of like the small pitch, the fact that the slope's really close to it. I saw Tom Kearney, interestingly, on the Footballers Football podcast, complaining about how difficult it is to take a corner at Craven Cottage because of that slope. I'm sure that it all plays a tiny little factor. When joined together, we've always had a good record at Craven Cottage, and there's something comes into it. As you say, we're not the most vociferous. I find that a strange comment from Tim Howard,
yeah,
personally.
I think that's lazy punditry, if I'm honest, more than anything else. I think that's just been like, oh, Fulham are a nice club. That's an easy place to go. Yeah, like that lot of yap, very little substance.
Yeah, I agree. This next one from Mitchell, he says, hey lads, today we saw Iwobi squander a lot of good crossing opportunities along with some poor misplaced passes. I thought back and realised that this isn't the first time we've seen this. Last week was the exact same except for the assist, and generally he's been quite poor in a lot of games over the last few months, particularly his end product. This isn't to say he's a bad player or should be dropped. After all, it is fun to watch him spin away from defenders. We're clearly a better team when he's playing, but I don't understand how this is possible. Just wanted to know your thoughts on this. I couldn't agree more with this email, because I am like, I want Iwobi in the team, but like my patience is running a little bit thin. Maybe it's a similar thing to Pereira, where actually, you know, we had a lot of times where I think everyone's called for Pereira to be dropped because he kept making individual mistakes. I think we've now, by and large, it feels like the majority view is that we're a better team with Pereira, and people have realised that. Is it a similar thing with Iwobi?
I think he's one of our very few players who has like guile on a football pitch. Like Pereira offers a lot, but he's not, you wouldn't be like, oh yeah, he's a player full of guile. Mm. Willian's really the only other one. And that's, even that feels a little bit more like trickery and sort of ability to beat a man, stand them up. Whereas sometimes you watch a Iwobi play and he just sort of like swishes through three players. You're like, how have you done that? And how did you even see that? That didn't look like it was on. I actually I completely agree with a lot of this, and I think that it was getting some weird stick at the weekend that I was like, you know, people calling him lazy. I hate that. He's a languid footballer, and that doesn't make him lazy. He actually works incredibly hard.
Yeah.
He just looks like he's running a bit through treacle, which is, you know, fine. That's his natural style. But I don't think anyone should ever compare that to his work rate. He was a little bit sloppy at the weekend, I think, and actually errant. And I actually was going to say this in the Palace section, that I actually wouldn't mind seeing him dropped at the weekend, because I think it might just re-energise him if he came off the bench to be able to impact. And maybe also, if you are, and Marco is thinking about how Pereira can play, being able to bring Iwobi on in that 10 space, I think is an interesting thing to be able to change a game late on. So I wouldn't mind seeing Wilson at the weekend. I wouldn't mind seeing Wilson, Muniz and Willian as a front three, just to see if we can get that going again, and to have Iwobi as a kind of slot to come in wherever he decides he's going to bring him on, that might just re-energise him ahead of the Brentford game.
I think also Iwobi's a great sub, and that's how
he's versatile.
That's how he broke into the team back, you know, when at the start of the season, he came in late in the window and he made some great sub appearances. And eventually we were like, okay, this guy's too good off the bench to not be starting. And I remember when he came back from AFCON, I think we brought him on after 45 minutes against Villa. And again, he was brilliant in that game off the bench. He can offer some. I'm not saying that, like, right, he should be destined to the bench forever.
He should, in Fulham's best team, Alex Iwobi plays, but I just think for this game, it might just be worth just giving him a slight breather and maybe just a kind of a little nudge to be like, hey, your spot isn't guaranteed, earn it. And that's fine. And, you know, players need that motivation and challenge. And also Harry Wilson, you know, has been working hard to get back in. I think that there is a space for him to have a go here. If Iwobi was playing brilliantly, I would say don't change anything. But he's not at the moment. So therefore, Wilson should be banging on that door and being like, well, can I have an opportunity? Because I also am a very good footballer.
Yeah. This one from Aldwin Boscawen. He says, dear Sammy and the team, long time emailer, first time listener.
That's very good.
Call me out there as well. I did not read this enough beforehand. Aldwin says, in some of my previous correspondence, I have made no secret that I do not feel like Tony Khan is fit for his role at this club. I was frustrated to see that as soon as Fulham get a televised fixture against a title contender, all of a sudden the AEW logo is on the team sheet and their advertising is all over this in the hoardings. Their presence is increasingly visible on our website, and yet they have never been announced as our official wrestling acting BDSM partner, as far as I'm aware. Maybe we stopped doing that after the Titan capital market scheme we onboarded. I would be very interested to know whether AEW are paying full whack and this is an arm's length transaction for all the visibility, or whether we are just being used yet again as a ladder for AEW, as he used us to get on ITV in the first place. I didn't know that particular last line. And that's from Aldwin. I mean,
I don't think they will be paying for that.
No, they won't be paying.
To be honest, wouldn't hugely be expecting them to.
Isn't this just part of having a network?
Yeah, I don't think it makes any of those points move, what it's worth. I think there's a lot in there to dissect and a lot of there that you can appreciate, but I didn't know that thing about ITV either. But there is definitely a sense of when you, like, if things are owned by different clubs, then obviously those things are advertised. I don't have a huge problem with the lack of paid partnership between two firms within basically the same, you know, structure or organization. But I do find it being a bit odd on the team sheet. I got sent a picture of that with it circled at the weekend. And I was a bit like, what? Like, that's just a bit random. I don't really see what anyone's, like, I get the advertising around the hoardings on TV. Like, I understand, right? It's not great, like, viewing for me, but because I don't watch wrestling, but I understand why that's happening. The bit on the team sheet, I was just a bit confused by. It doesn't really make any sense.
But it's just advertising, right? They know that journos, such as Peter, you see him do it quite a lot, just simply take a photo of the team sheet and then put it on Twitter, right? It's just, for me, as much as there's like, I'm not like convinced that anyone can run all three franchises like Tony Khan does and still do the job that he needs to, I think that's a separate point. But yeah, I just feel like this is inter-network advertising. You know, I'm in the radio world, and Global own a lot of the billboards around London, and that's why you see Capital Heart Radio X advertised on them all the time. They take the kind of free space don't exactly know how it works, but loosely, they take the free space on those billboards as and when it's available because they've got something else to promote and they might as well have something on there. Isn't that kind of, you know, if this is probably the kind of thing that appeals to owners like the Khans in order of owning franchises so they can advertise other things, grow them, etc. I don't know.
I don't think I've ever seen the Boston Red Sox on a Liverpool team sheet, despite both being owned by FSG. But I've never seen the Pittsburgh Penguins.
No, but AEW are obviously trying to promote their Wembley events to people in London.
Yeah, I mean, are the Red Sox not playing in that baseball thing? I thought they were, maybe not.
And maybe they don't need to sell the tickets for that, and the onus on that is on the MLB to sell tickets, yeah. Probably not the Red Sox. I mean, like, we see it all the time. I think Infinite Athlete is connected to Todd Bowley at Chelsea, and they're his sponsor. He was invested in that stupid film, Argyle.
That was weird, and they had like a halftime show. It's true, we haven't got to halftime shows yet. I think that might be the line.
Yeah, I just feel like it's one of those.
Don't cross the line.
A symptom of modern football, sadly, but I don't know. There's some things that I take up problem with, but that was one of them that it just washes over me. I didn't even notice that it was particularly more the Liverpool game than
I didn't notice until someone sent it to me, to be fair.
Yeah,
but that might just show me how blind we are to advertising at this point. It's just everywhere.
Yeah. George Lehman asks, great pod, found the Mooney's Dom Solanke comparison interesting on the Thursday pod. It's unlikely, but would you do a straight swap for Solanke and Mooney's? I don't think I would personally. If you had to do a straight swap for any striker from a bottom half team, who would you pick? I'd pick Cunha at Wolves, who gives young Dembele early Fulham player vibes. Also, on Wikipedia, it says Flamengo have a 20% future clause on future transfers for Mooney's. Not really ideal if this is the case. Sounds like they always knew he was going to be a player. Can't really remember any previous Fulham players this has been the case for. So there's a couple of things in there. I guess in a hypothetical world, would you trade Rodrigo Mooney's for Dom Solanke?
I'm just trying to see how old Dom Solanke is I don't know how old he is. 26, 27?
I'd have thought he's about that.
I think the sensible answer is probably yes at this point. And again, that's coming from someone who doesn't really like Dom Solanke. I don't think he's brilliant. But I think that he's got probably more on his space and in his camp at this point than Mooney's has. As much as I like Rodrigo and I want him to succeed, I think if someone offered you that swap, my brother put this to me the other day. He was like, if someone offered 30 million for Mooney's right now, we should sell him. And I was like, you're probably right. It's a gamble. And if he goes on to become absolutely exquisite, then yes. But 30 million pounds is a lot of money. My counter was like, what do you buy for 30 million? Can you buy, you know, how much money do we have to play with? And that will then depends on what else is in the kitty, etc. But I do think that if someone offered that money, you probably, the sensible move for the club would probably be to move him on. That's a massive profit without all that much exposure in a couple of years.
Yeah.
I do like that shout in terms of Cunha. I like him, but I still don't really think he's a number nine that plays out on his own. So considering, annoyingly, Brighton are one out of the top 10, so I can't swing for Evan Ferguson here. But the player I would probably bring in is Taiwo Awoniyi at Nottingham Forest, who I think is absolutely brilliant. I think he's top four striker in waiting. I think he's absolutely exceptional.
Okay. The final email is from Tim Miller. He says, hello, Thursday Club. Just been listening to my rendition of the Raw Band classic, although it appears none of you had ever heard of the track. So perhaps...
Oh, no, but it was fun and it was good. I did enjoy myself.
Perhaps not quite as classic as I thought. Well, there's some good news. The song was originated 40 years ago, and to commemorate this, the band have released an updated video. So he sends us the link to the updated video of Raw Band Clouds Across the Moon, which I will send to you.
Fantastic. I can't wait to see it. Was great, that. I enjoyed it immensely.
And we've had a lot of comments on last week's This Will Catch On. A lot of people enjoyed it. So thank you for everyone that messaged about that. No, This Will Catch On today because we're saving them for the live show, which is going to be amazing. There's some brilliant ones in there. So if you come into the live show, you're in for a treat, and it's going to get played on the podcast this time next week. Jack, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sammy. Been a real pleasure.
Thank you to Peter earlier for coming in. And we will be back. Well, there's the live show on Saturday, and then we will jump in the lab and we will turn around the live show and make it available to listen as a podcast on Monday morning, reacting to the Palace game. And then we'll be back this time next week, looking ahead to the big one, Brentford away.
The BTEC.
Yeah.
Oh, big West London derby.
It's going to be
family derby in my neck of the woods as well.
Yes, of course. Mm. All interspersed, you West Londoners.
Yeah, that's how we are. All scattered.
All right, have a lovely weekend, whatever you're doing. If you're coming to the live show, can't wait to see you there. If not, have a great weekend anyway. All right.
You wait.